All's Fair by K.C. Scribbler, read by Cookie Mom 6067. Breakfast, or whatever term each of the 18 cultures aboard assigns to the first meal of a 24-hour cycle, is one of Jim's favorite times of day aboard ship. Long gone are the mornings that he'd skip the meal entirely due to awkwardness, which would follow as soon as he sat at any occupied table in the mess. The uneasy looks and whispers and strict adherence to decorum and rules almost driving him so crazy he wouldn't be able to eat. No amount of informality and charm had quite broken down those barriers in that first unbelievably busy year, and he'd learned a very difficult lesson at its close. He knows he should have done more than just die for the ship to prove his loyalty to this crew, and that's a mistake he's never made again. Both the dying and the doing. He came aboard the Enterprise the first time with exactly one friend, and he still sometimes can't believe how lucky he's gotten since then. Certainly he hears the rumors at conferences or while on shore leaves. He's too informal, too familiar, unacceptably intimate with his crew, particularly his command officers. It's unbecoming of the flagship's command chain. It breaks one of the golden rules of captaincy. It's going to come back to bite him hard someday, etc., etc. Jealousy is a funny thing. But his people? They've been through hell and back, and then right back through it again with him. And he will not be swayed by some uninformed superior's warnings against a system that clearly works, and works incredibly well. His crew's efficiency ratings are at least 10% higher than the rest of the fleet's for a reason, thank you very much. He needs a staff that will call him on his bullshit, not blindly obey his every command, one that actually enjoys his company rather than tolerating it with a fake smile, one who has somehow, despite all odds and his own initial intentions, wormed their way under his skin to wrap around his heart. It would kill him to lose them now. Also, now he wants to kill them. It balances out somehow. He has not had enough caffeine for this, not by a long shot. Ignoring the excited chatter to his left for a moment, he flags down his current yeoman, a cheery young man who is entirely too eager to please, and begs him for another cup of coffee black. Garcia bounces away to the beverage selector, nearly bowling over a distracted biology ensign as they read from a pad while in line for pancakes. Jim sighs, pinching the bridge of his nose, and returns his attention to the table. "Stop using those poor kids for things like that," Bones scolds him in an undertone. "I make it up to them." He does, honestly. Even if it's literally in their job description, he doesn't make a habit of handing off menial duties to his direct reports of whatever station, and he typically tries to make it up to them in other ways, like a shorter duty shift today when they're heading out for shore leave. But this morning, he's afraid if he leaves the table, he'll come back to World War IV being plotted among some of the smartest people in the galaxy. So having someone fuel him is a necessary evil. "Aye, it sounds like good fun, but have you thought of the logistics? 'Twould be a right pain to do while the ship's still running." "Which is why I suggested it for tomorrow," Sulu replies, waving an impatient cereal spoon around to punctuate the point. A cornflake makes the swan dive back into the bowl with a tiny splash. With the ship 90% empty, it wouldn't be a logistical nightmare. "Just a regular nightmare," he points out as the yeoman returns with his coffee. "Thank you, Mr. Garcia. Take off now. Enjoy your shore leave." "Aye, sir. Thank you, sir." The kid bounces away eagerly, no doubt already planning some activity as energetic as he is. More power to him. Gods, is he getting old? He shakes his head and takes a drink of the truly ghastly brew, then nearly spits it out. "Scotty, I have signed 3 work orders. When are you going to improve this? I have legitimately had better rations in a Klingon prison cell. 2x. "Oi, that's uncalled for, sir." "It's really not," Uhura interjects, looking dubiously into her own cup. It's the worst part of the menu, and that includes your precious haggis. Jim toasts her with his nearly empty cup. Captain, can we get back to the games? Sulu's puppy eyes are ridiculous, and after all these years, completely ineffective on him. So he's jaded. They should know better by now. Mr. Sulu, I believe I already made my position clear. No. He tries not to laugh at his pilot's crestfallen expression. But, sir... He's got to point, Captain, Scotty adds pleadingly. We wouldn't get a better opportunity than this. He rubs a thumb between his eyes and counts to 10. We literally have hundreds of other things to be doing in this downtime, guys. Grapevine bragging rights are not a good enough reason to sanction the madness on the Enterprise. Be the bigger man, or whatever, he adds, gesturing to the non-human male couple at the table. Spock ignores him, and Uhura snorts into her coffee cup. The bragging rights in question, being the optional crew efficiency evaluation scores that are becoming a trend among the newest starships. There is little recreation out in the void, and even less opportunity to stay connected to other ships once you pass Yorktown, and Starfleet has decided that means they need additional entertainment and an intership communication line to help people stay connected. A ridiculous waste of internal comms, power, and time, but no one asked him. Rather than improving their not exactly reliable holodeck technology, allowing them additional shore leave, or something actually useful, the newest thing to hit the nets is a war games module in which the crews of one or more starships can practice their offensive and defensive skills in various computer-generated simulations. The scores go on a virtual leaderboard, apparently, although he's not in any way interested in keeping up with them. His people are better, plain and simple. He doesn't need a scoreboard to tell him that. While the module is endorsed by the fleet, it is not yet mandatory training. It's probably useful in the long run, given the fleet's track record out here in the black, but he has to admit it's annoying to continually be notified through the comm line that another ship has scores he knows damn well they can beat with their eyes closed. Guys, I've looked at the simulations. They're not even a challenge. He glances down the table. Clearly someone wasn't consulted on the test parameters. Spock's tolerant eyebrow is his only response. His first continues calmly signing off on morning reports, with the occasional ting from his pad indicating a sternly worded addendum making its way back to the appropriate department head. Uhura hides a smile in her coffee cup before finishing the drink and setting it delicately on the table. So we tweak the simulations to make them more challenging. That's only fair, given we are the flagship. We have an undeniable advantage. He sends a look of betrayal down the table. Uhura shrugs, waving a hand in the air. What? We're all bored, sir. There's nothing crucial for us to do while the major systems are running diagnostics. What can it hurt? Seriously? He turns to his right. Bones? Don't drag me into this. I got plenty to do. McCoy gestures pointedly to the data pad he's been reading half-heartedly. Just because y'all are caught up doesn't mean the world stops for the rest of us. Captain, come on, the Potemkin is talking serious smack about us all over the starbase. Sulu looks across the table for corroboration, and Chekov nods solemnly. Duh, it is quite rude. He chugs the rest of his coffee and plunks the cup back down on the table with a sigh. How exactly do you propose to tweak the simulations? Mr. Spock already has a write-up of the programming adjustments, Chekov volunteers, and he turns an even more betrayed look across the table. Spock looks a bit guilty, but ultimately hands down the pad with the programming window pulled up on it. So what is this exactly? Nothing really groundbreaking, Captain. A modified version of the old Capture the Flag game. Sulu reaches over to point at a diagram on the pad. Divide the skeleton crew in half. One side has to capture an object and return it to home base in order to win. And you think that's more interesting than a simulated space battle scenario? He received several pairs of annoyed eyes in response. What? It's a child's game. Spock's eyebrow inclines. Then you have a more challenging scenario in mind? He blinks, not having really thought about it. I presumed not. The tone is legit condescending, and that's just rude, okay? All I'm saying is I just think even odds aren't the best indication of crew efficiency if that's what we're after, he points out. Since when is anything we run into a fair fight? The evaluation's going to be skewed in our favor if it's even odds. He has a point, Commander. Sulu glances between them for a minute. So, what do you suggest, sir? He reaches over and appropriates Bones' coffee, since it's just sat there for 30 minutes getting cold, and that's a waste. I mean, he sips it thoughtfully and then grimaces. 4 sugars just makes it taste worse somehow. If we really want to test efficiency, I think it should be pretty terrible odds. No risk, no reward, all that. Bridge to Captain Kirk, the Walcom unit interrupts the rest of his thought, and he vents a sigh, getting up to answer. Kirk here. Sir, Commodore Altheny is holding for you on Channel 3 to confirm details of our departure in 2 days. We need to coordinate a flight path due to heavy traffic around the base at our scheduled departure time. On my way. He moves back to the table to retrieve his tray and empty cups. Nah, I got it, Lieutenant. Even I can handle a flight path, he adds, seeing Uhura starting to stack her tray to accompany him. If you really want these games, stay and help them come up with something more situation appropriate. I have work to do. Is that a challenge, sir? Sulu eyes him speculatively. Sure, whatever. He shakes his head in amusement over the balancing act he's doing with the tray. Spock, keep the kids in line, please. He hears a smattering of laughter behind him as he walks away toward the recycling chute, followed by a furious burst of whispers and furtive looks his direction. It's apparently going to be one of those days. She hadn't been stretching the truth earlier, that most of them are actually bored. Their shore leave here had not been planned in advance, and when that happens at a critically busy time of the shipping cycles, sometimes the starbase has to limit shore leave parties, simply due to capacity. Because of this limitation, the primary command officers aboard the Enterprise had all declined leave, despite being given first choice, in order to allow the rest of the crew a few more minutes of leisure. They are then taking the opportunity, while in orbit, to run through diagnostics on every system, preparing to make any adjustments necessary their last day here, before heading back out into the void, ever further from Starfleet civilization. There was a time that they'd have cashed in their perks, certainly. They've all grown up a little since then. But with most major systems in standby mode for diagnostics, there's very little for any of them to actually do aboard other than stare at a status bar, and this crew really does not deal with boredom very well. They don't talk about the 5 days of dead time they had last time they docked for a computer refit. It's this, or they'll all be at each other's throats at the end of the 48 hours they're in orbit, so she's leaning toward the side of the stupid games. Even Spock had wearily given ground on his original stance after the relentless barrage from their new intership comm line kept pinging her pad last night at all hours. Like all media trends, it will die soon, but for now it's just annoying. They reconvene for evening mess after a day that has just seemed to drag. This gathering is unusual in itself, since they don't typically all have the free time at the same time to actually sit down for a meal nowadays, and even more so with the ship nearly empty. It's a little spooky in the deserted officers' mess tonight, the motion-activated lights over their table being the only ones that don't keep flicking off periodically. The novelty of the situation isn't a bad thing, but the fact that Jim looks about 30 seconds from strangling one of them, as the discussion of the morning picks up right where it left off, is. What do you mean, that's not good enough? Kirk gestures with his water glass, narrowly avoiding dripping on what looks like a ridiculously large Mediterranean-inspired sandwich. Clearly that replication script had been designed by Scotty. Why the man can't fix the coffee script is beyond her. I mean that if you want to waste 24 hours playing a war game, you shouldn't just use the holodeck for a simulation. That's a cop-out. Another reason I'm not worried about the Potemkin scores. The holodeck is what the games were designed for, Sulu points out. And you already nixed the capture the flag idea. Yeah, because it's pointless. When we've seen 10 times worse already than anything the computer can throw at us, if we're going to prove better crew efficiency, it at least needs to be a non-computerized challenge. Scott looks vaguely intrigued. Like what? The rest of the crew against us, you mean? Kirk shrugs. It'd at least be more of a competence indicator than even odds against a simulation. Wait, I have an idea. I'm listening, Mr. Sulu. Kirk puts his sandwich back down, uneaten, gesturing for their pilot to go ahead. Crew against us? No. Crew against you. Jim blinks. Spock sits up just a little straighter. Attell, unnoticeable by anyone but her, probably. You did say you wanted more challenging odds, sir, she says helpfully, over the top of her tea mug. Yeah, but that doesn't even make sense, Sulu. Why not? The young man leans forward, ticking points off on his fingers. You wanted a challenge. We want something the crew can brag about for the next year, and you're the one outnumbered here anyway. Pull your weight. Mr. Sulu. Spock's warning tone is not amused. Sorry. Pull your weight, sir. Jim snorts and leans back in his chair, arms folded. Even I am not stupid enough to take on all of you in something like Capture the Flag. That's purely a numbers and timing game. There's next to no strategy involved. He's right. It's still not challenging enough to be an indicator of competency, at least. She pulls up the programming for the simulation mainframe, flicks it upward into 3D mode, hovering over the table. The original simulation calls for a space battle. A boarding party, race unknown, attacking the ship while the engines are offline. From there, the computer chooses one of 200 simulations designed to test both offensive and defensive strategies for each category of crewmen. Easy enough to replicate in the holodeck, but we'd wreck the ship in the process if we did anything remotely like that outside it. Jim looks down the table pointedly at his youngest bridge crew members. Find something else. The principle of Capture the Flag isn't a bad idea, she muses, tapping a stylus thoughtfully on the pad. We just need a clearer target objective and more realistic methods of indicating player status than colored flags and tagging each other or whatever. Such as? We could depower the phasers. Light stun mode isn't designed to do more than sting a bit. Hell no, McCoy interjects, pointing a fork down the table at their hapless pilot. Even on that setting, a direct hit to the head could seriously brain or nerve damage someone, and you know damn well we're disaster prone as it is. He's right. Even if they're powered down, I'm not going to waive that regulation. Jim leans forward slightly. Scotty, what do you use for training missions that don't take place in the holodeck? Like planet-side drills, that kind of thing. Nothing very exciting. 'Tis a sort of foam, sir, non-toxic and biodegradable, since it's usually used on a deserted planet. Expands to 4 times its mass within a few seconds of contact with the air, and then disappears just as quick. Shouldn't leave any residue once it dries. We didn't have practice phasers, though. Only adapted phaser rifles and grenades. Well, that would work. She raises an eyebrow at the incredulous look she receives. Don't tell me you're afraid of a little foam, Captain. Kirk rolls his eyes. I cannot believe I'm actually considering this. Ah, so you are considering, then. Slow your roll, Scotty, he warns, clearly fighting back a laugh. You're 100% sure this foam, or whatever, won't leave a mess behind. I'll not have anyone come back from shore leave and have to clean up after us like we're a bunch of junior cadets. Negative, sir. Shouldn't need any cleaning. Be a bit slippery until the residue dries, but it breaks down soon after. So what is the flag, then? Chekhov asked, bouncing eagerly in his seat. Should be something not so easy to reach or bring back over enemy lines. Something on the bridge. It's the hardest place to get in and out of. What with the turbolift bottleneck, she suggests. The port side lift had been offline for the last week while its anti-grav mechanisms are replaced and thoroughly tested. So there's just the one entrance and exit now, unless one wants to climb 12 decks up a turboshaft. Ooh, I know, your chair, Captain. Sulu waves a hand in the vague direction of the bridge. If you're sitting in it by the end of the game, you win. You're not in it when the time's up, we win. Full bragging rights. A snort. Fine. But the time period needs to be 24 hours or less, guys. Our people start beaming back aboard after 26, and they don't need to be walking into a civil war. Copy that, 24 hours, she replies with a grin, carefully adjusting the simulation's programming to accommodate the new parameters they've discussed. Anything else we should be specifying? Mr. Scott, you will need to distribute practice weapons and ammunition. Spock glances around the table with an air of the much aggrieved, as if he hadn't himself been asking for this. We must also outline parameters for gameplay to prevent any creative interpretation of the rules. She stifles a laugh as Jim mouths, "Who, me?" from across the table, looking hurt.
When we do practice missions, it doesn't matter where you're hit. You're just out if you're hit, Scott volunteers cheerily. Gives a little extra incentive to be on the ball, you might say.
So you get hit anywhere, you're eliminated. Eliminated meaning not eligible for the evaluation. I don't want casualties hurting the scores of anyone still in the game. Any problem with that? A variety of head shakes, and in McCoy's case, completely ignoring them in favor of responding to a message on his pad. Bones?
Yes, fine, whatever. But if one of you ends up in sickbay because of something stupid we call the game, and all gameplay has to take place here on the ship, the Starbase has enough to deal with.
Agreed, Doctor. Spock glances over to her and she nods, waving the pad. All programming adjusted, the computer will recognize anyone getting hit and automatically eliminate them, adjusting the efficiency score totals accordingly.
Kirk sighs and empties his water glass.
Fine. I didn't have anything to do for the next day anyway. He stands and leans forward with both hands on the table and a positively evil smile. Anyone who wants to back out now probably should.
Sulu snorts and shovels the rest of his dinner in his mouth. Commander, you really up for a rematch here? Making cracks about my dead father isn't going to help you this time.
Oh, shots fired.
Spock's lips twitch suspiciously, but he merely inclines his head in silent agreement.
I'd say the time starts now. She points at the door with her stylus. You have a 5-minute head start, sir.
Yes, ma'am.
Kirk throws up his hands, causing the lights at the surrounding tables to flick on in an accompaniment of unintentionally dramatic flare.
Don't forget I warned you.
He shoots a grin over his shoulder as he leaves the mess, not quite at a run.
Damn idiot, always making me clean up after him, McCoy mutters, starting to stack Kirk's empty cup and still full plate on his own tray. 'Cause I got nothing better to do.
Doctor, wait. Spock's words are abruptly punctuated by what can only be categorized as an explosion of foam from the uneaten sandwich, which promptly dissolves into a puddle of pinkish mush around what is clearly a spraying mechanism of some kind. The foam, on the other hand, goes everywhere, all over the entire table, and 2 meters of surrounding area. No one is spared.
Jim, you asshole!
Their CMO hurls the now empty plate at the door like a particularly dangerous frisbee, a wild spray of foam flinging off his arm in its wake. She cannot help it because it's too funny. Sliding down in her now slick chair, she shakes with the force of her laughter.
every single one of them taken out before the game even begins. They have made a huge mistake.
That was obviously just a warning, since we haven't technically started yet, Kirk's loud voice sing-songs through the wall-com.
Remember, this was your idea, people. Game starts now.
What the hell? Sulu sputters, scraping pink foam off his face and out of his hair. Was that whole discussion just a setup?
This outcome should not have been unexpected. Spock wearily flings the foam off his face with both hands, although it still clings to his hair like shampoo suds. It was a grave tactical error, allowing a period of 12 hours between postulating the idea and determining parameters for the game in question, with his input, no less.
She finally stops giggling and stands to shake the foam off her arms and shoulders. It's already starting to dissolve in the air, but it doesn't dry, certainly. They're all going to be wet and sticky for at least a few minutes, which was very likely Jim's intent. It sends a strong message and gives him a head start.
We do have 24 hours, Scotty ventures, much less confidently.
Yay. Chekhov's doleful voice from under a veritable mountain of pink suds sets her off all over again, giggling even as she heads to the bridge to cut Kirk off at the knees with the comms, at least. They very likely are all metaphorical dead men, but they'll go down swinging.
It's simple enough to cut the visual and audio comms across the ship, although she doubts very much that the systems will stay down, given the captain's skill at computer work. However, between her and Spock, they've managed to disable most, if not all, terminal input other than sickbay, their cabins, and the bridge. So it's not like he can hide in a Jeffrey's tube somewhere and override their codes to re-engage the cameras and audio systems. He'd have to be at one of only a few unlocked terminals to do so. They have chosen the most expedient strategy of divide and conquer, and have sent Sulu and Chekhov up to man the bridge, for now, and keep the diagnostics running. No one expects Kirk to make any kind of move that direction until far later in the 24-hour period, but you never know. They, conversely, have done a cursory sweep of engineering their cabins and sickbay just because it would be like Kirk to hide in plain sight. Of course, he's not doing that. In fact, the remaining 4 hours before ship's midnight go by slowly, but completely uneventfully. While all's fair in war games, it is at heart just a game, and she can only hope Jim is getting a good night's sleep himself, thereby allowing them to do the same. They are none of them as young as they used to be. They set up a watch roster, and precisely at ship's midnight, she and Spock are relieved by Montgomery Scott and a young engineer who'd remained behind, not enjoying the anticipated crowds on the starbase. There are perhaps 20 more crewmen aboard besides the primary command crew, all of whom have now been looped into the madness unfolding. It's a little hilarious how it literally does not seem to faze them in the slightest. They've definitely seen worse, and it shows. They'll just be collateral damage in the next 12 hours anyway, because she would not bet on their chances.
He can't stay off the sensors forever, she mutters, flicking through the security footage of the recreation decks. There are a few places where motion has triggered a recording, and while there's no regulation against it, there really shouldn't be anyone on those decks while the ship's on a skeleton crew. I fully expected him to wipe his digital presence, but it's odd that not even the medical scanners have pinged his location in the last 6 hours. That blood type of his has all kinds of weird markings that make him way too easy to identify.
Spock pauses in the act of buttoning his pajama shirt, having spent the last 2 hours in only vaguely successful meditation.
Dr. McCoy has not found any indication of his still being aboard.
Not according to his last message. Granted, it's not that difficult to stay hidden from shipwide sensors, and there's any number of ways you can mask a life signature, especially if he was preparing for this all day. But I had expected to get a glimpse of him on camera somewhere, at the least. No sound bites, no visual clips, nothing medical. It's not like him to just sit still somewhere, not when he feels like he has something to prove. What's his game, do you think?
I would venture to speculate. His immediate strategy is simply the passage of time. There is no logical reason to take offensive action at this early stage.
Because even if it's 24 hours, only that last one is really going to matter.
Precisely.
Also because it is the most likely to produce the desired outcome with the least amount of energy expended.
She shuts off the footage because there's nothing there, and turns in her chair, starting to take down her ponytail.
Lazy isn't exactly his command style.
It is not. However, the primary strategy of his chess games can be characterized best as last-minute inspiration.
Spock half hates, half loves playing against the captain for obvious reasons, and she knows while Jim doesn't particularly enjoy the game for its own sake, it's become a comforting habit in past years.
He's not half bad, either. He just can't sit still for long enough to really draw a game out.
So you think he's just going to bide his time until late tomorrow?
Nyota, I most sincerely do not claim to have any idea what precisely he is going to do. You will recall I advised against this course of action at the beginning for this exact reason.
Someone's snippy tonight.
You did, but you're in it now as deep as the rest of us.
She snorts at his peeved look, which on anyone else would be nothing more than a facial twitch.
Better to choose your alliances than the next 18 hours carefully, Ashalik. No one likes a double agent.
She's not above throwing him under the proverbial shuttlecraft if need be. Her file could use those efficiency ratings.
They are awakened at 0200 hours precisely on the dot by an automated alarm from the ship's systems.
Why is the transporter not locked down? She asks after Scott's report, understandably cranky.
Gotti's face is weary and he shrugs.
It was, last I checked. And it's not as if we had someone standing guard. And before you ask, the coordinates, biosignature, and fingerprint records were disabled at the time.
Spock leans over her shoulder at the desk, and Scott winces visibly.
Mr. Scott, are you insinuating that the captain has left the ship?
Well, sir, not necessarily.
Computer, location of Captain James T. Kirk.
Working.
Captain James T. Kirk is not aboard the USS Enterprise.
That's not necessarily true, she points out. He's more than good enough to make it look like he's not here.
Aye, but how are we to know for sure?
Pretty sure that's the whole point, Scotty. She sighs and leans back in the chair.
We never did specify in the rules that any player had to remain aboard, did we? Only that gameplay couldn't be taken down to the base.
You are correct.
Spock looks a bit like he'd prefer to just go back to bed and never come out.
It is another tactical oversight.
I swear, if he's down there sleeping in a comfortable hotel room while we're up here on edge for the next 12 hours.
I mean, we did ask for it a bit.
Shut up, Scotty.
Scott's face creases in a grin.
Aye, shutting up, Commander. You want me to do any investigating on this?
Negative, Mr. Scott. Investigating will do little to actually assist us. The captain must return to the ship before the end of the time allotted, and we cannot take action on the starbase, so there is very little benefit in attempting to ascertain his current strategy. We are, by default, in a state of defense rather than offense.
Aye, sir. I'll keep you both informed if we see anything. Scott out.
I'm going to kill him, she says, matter-of-factly, as she flops back down onto the bed.
Spock's soft exhale is his equivalent of a tired laugh.
I will not stand in your way, Kadiwa.
She snorts into the pillow and soon drops off again. Only to be awakened precisely 2 hours later at exactly 0400 hours. The Cardassian phrase she snarls into the pillow gets her a very raised eyebrow, but they're both awake on the instant because that sound is the horrible, overly solemn bell toll that indicates someone's been disqualified from the game.
It's funereal. There's no other way to describe it.
Why in the world's the module decided to add unnecessary drama that way, she has no idea. What's far more important is that their comm screen flicks into life before they can ask the computer who the unfortunate crewman is that has had the first run-in.
When the viewer comes on, Spock stops, momentarily stymied.
Well, that's not great.
Leonard, what happened? She demands, sitting at the monitor with more force than is really warranted.
That goddamn yeoman of his just chucked a grenade through my office door. That's what happened.
The vocal pitch is ceiling high and rising, along with the color on McCoy's face, barely visible behind a wall of pink foam. Spock's eyes close momentarily, and she only holds back laughter with a huge effort.
Garcia? He's supposed to be on shore leave.
Clearly, the captain did not beam himself off the ship 2 hours ago. Rather, he transported a recruit to his cause back aboard, Spock says wearily. He is most persuasive when the occasion requires. She looks back at McCoy, who is viciously scrubbing foam off his face with what looks like a wad of gauze.
Is Garcia still alive, Doctor?
He's fine, their CMO growls, flinging the damp cloth somewhere off camera.
Damn fool took off running before the thing even hit the desk. If I find him, though.
Why did he come after you first, anyway?
I'm guessing he wanted me out of the way because it'd be easiest for me to get him to let his guard down. I got no real idea.
I think you should probably be flattered, Doctor.
She hides a smile at the death glare she receives through the screen.
Also, where is he even getting ammunition? Scotty recounted and redistributed it right before midnight, and there wasn't much to begin with.
We bit off more than we can chew here, that's for sure. If nothing's missing, then I'm guessing he stocked up yesterday right after breakfast in preparation.
Spock sighs audibly.
I believe we may safely assume the captain is indeed still aboard, despite the computer's statement to the contrary.
You don't say, McCoy replies dryly.
Y'all are on your own now. At least I can get this backlog of work done. I guess that's something.
Actually, Doctor, Spock side-eyes her and then looks back to the screen.
I believe this may work in our favor.
Huh?
We outlined a set of rules stating that eliminated players were simply ineligible for the evaluation.
And?
We said nothing in the rules about an eliminated player actually being required to stop active gameplay or even take an inactive role.
Why, Commander? Am I hearing you suggest we creatively interpret the parameters of the game?
McCoy's eyes are positively dancing with evil glee.
There is no reason we should not. Nowhere in the parameter code does it precisely state eliminated players must cease gameplay, only that the computer will no longer track their actions.
Oh, of course, creative interpretation. Definitely logical.
Spock's eyebrow inclines.
Do you disagree?
No, I do not, Mr. Spock, the doctor retorts, finally shedding his sticky overshirt and snagging a scrubs top from the hook on the wall behind him.
I think it's the only way we stand a chance of coming out on top. I'm just surprised to hear you suggesting it is all.
Whatever your opinions of my human shortcomings, Doctor, I most definitely do learn from my past errors. This is no exception.
You're recording that for your next domestic disagreement, Lieutenant?
She snorts and terminates the connection. She suspects Jim is monitoring any transmission of a particular length, and also that he likely was already planning on them bending the rules however they can. Taking out McCoy might have been strategy, or might just have been Jim being dramatic, but either way, it's going to make all of them jump at shadows until this stupid game is over.
It, embarrassingly, takes two more cycles for them to realize the captain is doing something every 2 hours on the dot, and another two before they are slapped rudely in the face with his endgame. As of 1,200 hours, Kirk has single-handedly, and with extremely methodical determination, picked off every single crewman aboard who is not part of his senior staff, and has apparently given them permission to take the rest of their duty shifts off once eliminated, leaving said senior staff, alone to juggle departmental nonsense and track down their missing people all over the ship, in addition to the pre-planned drama, not to mention every 2 hours on the dot, that damned bell tolling, counting down their increasingly desolate numbers. It's an effective enough strategy, she has to admit, around midday, and it teaches them all a valuable lesson. The rest of the skeleton crew get unexpected shore leave of sorts after being eliminated from the equation, and the command staff have to wear themselves out running the ship, leaving very little time to actually worry about this stupid game. It's embarrassingly simple, this strategy, and it's a little insulting that he's stumping them so thoroughly and with so little effort. He's just running out the clock, and it's working. Why did we agree to this again? Sulu whines over a very thoroughly inspected chicken sandwich at the hurried luncheon several of them convene over at ship's noon. Spock has the bridge and Scott the lower decks, though at this point it's more damage control than any offensive maneuver. Pretty sure you are the main voice in favor of it. Pretty sure I didn't expect it to be such a pain in the ass. He shrugs and dives back into his lunch. We were still supposed to have a skeleton crew and be able to track him. No one's even seen him, not even the people he eliminated. Well, we should have expected that, and we don't have a skeleton crew anymore, so we can't really do much about it. She scrolls through another series of surveillance videos, only to come up with nothing. How in the world is he moving through the ship without being seen? McCoy, who has up until now been blithely ignoring them all and enjoying his disqualified status, leans over to peer at the footage. Run that back? She glances skeptically at him, but does. One more time, Lieutenant. Yep, right there. He jabs a finger at the screen, halting the footage over a blue shirt who stands typing on a pad with his back to the camera, just outside of secondary engineering. Oh my God! She's 99% sure that Spock's shirt, based on the sleeve stripes, which makes it even more hilarious. It's probably just due to the fact that their cabins adjoin, and as such are accessible via each other's, rather than a deliberate, snarky statement, but it's going to be hysterical to point out later, when they've all cooled down a bit. I'd recognize that lean anywhere. He's probably wearing colored lenses to throw off the facial recognition program. The scanner programming would be looking for facial recognition, command gold, and number of stripes on the sleeve, so it isn't surprising he slipped by so far. It's a lot easier than reprogramming the computer to actively say he's not aboard. Just trick it into thinking that. Then he only has to mask his bio readings and he's golden. Duh, much easier, and would not leave his electronic signature in the reprogramming code to trace back to the terminal he used. Well, that explains why he was able to get close enough to pick off the entire science crew on duty before anyone could sound an alarm. He probably walked right by at least one of us at some point. Probably. McCoy shakes his head and returns to his iced tea. He definitely has not been on the sickbay deck, and he'll stay that way if he knows what's good for him. I got a fire suppressant system primed and ready to drown him as soon as he steps foot in my territory. She sighs and drops the pad on the table, rubbing at her temples. We have just over 5 hours left to pull this off. I think it's time we started taking an offensive approach, rather than just continuing to be on the defense, Sulu says, leaning back in his chair. But I feel like he's expecting that. He's definitely already thought about the fire suppressant system, and he's clearly not using it for whatever reason, probably because it'd be too easy. If he really wanted, he could have taken us all out within an hour. She taps her stylus thoughtfully on the pad. You think we should use it if he's held off? It's not exactly being a good sport, but at this point they need every advantage. I mean, he's probably got some way to either cut off the commands that trigger it, or a way to stay dry. The system's got some definite blind spots, too, and I'm sure he knows exactly where they are. The elimination alert tone chimes again solemnly in the momentary silence, and they all groan as one. She picks up the pad and pulls up the active player list. It's Garcia, she says, raising an eyebrow. "Guess he outlived his usefulness," McCoy mutters. "That's cold, Jim." A second alarm chimes and the status changes once more.
What the? Accidental elimination? What does that even mean?
The doctor cackles. "Means the kid shot himself in the foot, I'm guessing. Serves him right."
"I'm guessing that wasn't actually part of the plan," she muses aloud. "So if this is right, and he's out of henchmen, any more plans he has will have to be carried out by himself. We have a much better chance of cornering him if he's not holed up somewhere."
"True, unless we're overthinking it, and Garcia just wanted the rest of his shore leave," Sulu says dryly.
"Well, regardless of what the plan was, if he keeps to his two-hour schedule, he's going to do something in less than an hour."
"Da is likely. I will assist Meester Scott in engineering, since his other people have been eliminated."
"Doctor, do you want someone in sickbay with you?"
"What for?" McCoy replies sourly. "Lot of good it'd do me."
Amused, she points the stylus toward their pilot.
"Lower decks?"
"You got it. I'll hit the aft observation lounge, too."
"I'll see if Spock has any more ideas and meet you on the wreck deck, unless there's a sighting before then."
"Good luck, Lieutenant."
"Thank you, Lieutenant. Pretty sure we're going to need it."
It has been a ridiculous 24 hours, or close to it. He had at first been irritated enough with his staff to immediately dismiss the entire idea because they are not a bunch of green cadets needing to prove themselves against the Potemkin of all ships. But after examining the rosters and realizing that there really was very little for his smartest people aboard to do, he found himself considering that perhaps it'd be good for them. It certainly wouldn't hurt anything, and they rarely have this kind of downtime. As long as it is more of a challenge than that asinine simulated mission the Potemkin is bragging about down below. Honestly, it was the simplest solution in the entire module, and they're acting like they're God's gift to the fleet. He knows his people are the best in the business, and has zero problem telling anyone that who asks, or who doesn't ask, or who really doesn't care enough to ask. They're going to hear about it anyway. But if they want this optional score in their files to prove it to themselves, who is he to deny them the opportunity? With a few adjustments, of course. His initial actions do seem to catch them all by surprise. Most likely they were anticipating this being quick and easy, which isn't an unreasonable assumption given the other ship's recorded simulations. Each was under an hour. But his people are better than that, so he gives them 24. Or they'd give themselves 24, and he just agrees with nearly everything they say, before leaving them with a warning he is just a bit too proud of. He does love a dramatic exit. It's a matter of 60 seconds to patch into the computer mainframe while he's in the turbolift back to Deck 5, vocally transferring manual control to the data pad on his desk and deleting his electronic signature by the time he's halfway down the corridor. Uhura is going to cut him off from all internal systems within 5 minutes. He'd bet his ship. But she won't realize he's already placed a splicer program in the intercom's code, unless she takes it apart line by line, which she really has no reason to do. He's banking on that. He enters his cabin, snatches the pad and a refillable water bottle, and makes a pit stop in the cabin next door for a shirt change. It's a little snug, but it'll work well enough for his purpose, and he'll apologize for the invasion of privacy later. Plus, it'll be hilarious when they figure it out. He's back out the door in less than 40 seconds, hopping into the nearest Jeffrey's tube entrance as the lift dings to indicate someone else arriving on the deck, very likely one or more of his pissed-off command crew. Moments later, he's deep in the bowels of his strangely silent ship, and within 10 minutes or so, a Jeffrey's tube over secondary engineering. It would be foolish for his team to expend a huge amount of time and labor in these initial hours trying to catch him off guard, which is why he suspects Spock will direct them otherwise. There's one entrance to the dead end of this Jeffrey's tube, and with the addition of a foam grenade tripwire across it and motion sensors 10, 20, and 30 feet further out, he feels fairly confident in his safety for a long power nap.
Sure enough, the vibration of his alarm on the pad wakes him after precisely 3 hours, 30 minutes, and he stretches with a regretful sigh. Time to go to work. Bones jumps half out of his skin when he kicks the ventilator grate out of the wall, sending it clanging to the floor 10 feet below, and sending the phaser rifle flying down after it. He jumps then, landing in a crouched position, ready to move just in case his kill codes didn't actually work on the sickbay fire suppression systems. That motion sensor addition to the current commands was very, very sneaky, and he gives them all props for the fact that while eliminated, McCoy is still very much not out of play. He will keep a watchful eye out for a renegade hypospray. However, he had anticipated the fire suppressant strategy, since that is the one system aboard which is already designed to use foam. It would be stupid not to at least have it ready, and so he had disabled the command codes for it almost first thing. He can clearly see Bones is pissed that it's not working by the not subtle glances he's giving to the nozzles overhead. "Seriously?" he asks, genuinely offended. "I'm not an idiot, Bones." "No, you're not. If you were, you'd be trying to get on the bridge without being seen right now. Not my sick bay. You know you have less than 10 minutes left, right?" "Mm-hmm." Knowing his CMO can't use a weapon on record or the computer will call him out for breaking the elimination rules and immediately end the game in a draw, he feels relatively safe in taking a sprawling seat on Bones's couch, one eye on the door and weapon within reach. "Make yourself at home." "Oh, come on. You're holding a grudge." "You have no idea." "You said you had work to do." He waves the phaser rifle vaguely in the direction of the CMO. "I gave you time to do it. You should be thanking me." "All you did was stave off the inevitable. You know Spock is on to you." "Is he? Are you sure about that?" McCoy leans back in his chair, looking a little too satisfied. "Surer than you, apparently." He sits up slowly and with a wary look at the only exit in the room. "Pretty sure all you did was piss him off enough that he planted himself on the bridge all day, ready to take you on himself when you got around to trying something, which I'm guessing was your primary strategy. Keep him up there so he couldn't catch on to anything you were doing below." "That's smart, actually, but he literally hadn't been thinking that hard about it. He thought it would be funny to take Bones out immediately, and even funnier if he did it at a time that would disrupt everyone else's sleep schedules. He's not above pressing an advantage if there's not going to be permanent harm done. There hadn't been any long-term strategy in that. He just had hours to kill." McCoy seems to see this in his expression because he drags a hand down his face and starts to laugh. "You really were just kicking the hornet's nest at regular intervals. Nothing more strategic." "Well, yeah," he shrugs. "Work smarter, not harder." "And by smarter, you have some Hail Mary to pull in the next 5 minutes?" "Maybe," he hedges, just as the computer automatically projects a holographic 5-minute countdown on the nearest wall. It's going to count down in every location it registers a life signature, so everyone knows he's going to make a move now or never. "Might as well get on with it then." "I need to borrow this," he says, moving McCoy's monitor around so it's facing him instead. He receives a rude gesture as his CMO gets up and moves toward a nearby cabinet, and he laughs as he puts a call through to the bridge. Uhura tries to not look surprised when she answers, but he can tell she's just as clueless as the rest of them, and more than a little annoyed. "Put me on visual, please, Lieutenant." She raises an eyebrow, but immediately transfers him to the main viewer, giving him a nice clean view of the command dais and the backside of the bridge. Spock looks a little bored, but not particularly worried, as he sits in the center chair. "How's it going?" he asks with an innocent smile. Out of the viewer's field, he brings up a remote command window on his pad and starts uploading the command codes he'd saved earlier. Spock's jaw actually twitches. "I believe you are aware of the current state of affairs, sir," Yes. Yes, I am. So we have what, 2:30 left?
That is correct. Spock's eyes flicked to the side and then back to him. As it appears you are currently located in sickbay, which I may add was not unexpected, we will be pleased to accept your capitulation. The odds are 1 in 35,704 that you would even be able to reach the bridge before the time has expired.
The sass is so real.
He inputs the last command and then looks back up.
Well, you have me there, Commander. Far be it from me to argue with your odds.
Spock looks hella suspicious and stands to move closer to the front screen. And that's all he needs.
But you know, we only specified that I had to be sitting in my chair when the countdown hit, he says, setting the phaser rifle down. And well, no one said it had to still be on the bridge, did they?
Spock half turns as he hears the transporter lock take hold, and Jim hears the disbelieving exclamation from Sulu as the chair itself disappears in a shimmer of tachyon particles. Doing a non-stabilized cargo transport is not particularly safe if someone's sitting in the object, but it's low risk enough without a life form, and he's not a monster. If Spock hadn't stood up, he would have just gone to plan B or C to get him out for a second. He hears the familiar creak of faux leather as the chair materializes just behind him and sprawls in it with a definitive thwack. It rocks slightly in the absence of supports keeping it attached to the floor, but is stable enough. He smirks back up at the screen as the countdown flips to 3 seconds, 2, then 1, and finally 0.
I believe that's a checkmate, Mr. Spock.
Spock looks back at him for one brief second, and then actually legit, honest to God, smiles, just ever so slightly. So small, if he wasn't suspicious already, he'd miss it.
Computer, end simulation.
Wait, what? The chair turns to nothing under him, dumping him unceremoniously on the floor with a muffled yelp. He hears McCoy's cackles of laughter from across the desk and a chorus of puzzled exclamations on the bridge as he blinks, genuinely mystified.
What the fuck, Spock?
Mental note, his professionalism apparently disappeared with his chair.
As you said, we did not specify that the chair must remain on the bridge. Therefore, I took the liberty of relocating it and instead utilized a localized adaptation of the holodeck technology to simulate its appearance and identical mass at these coordinates. Your transporter diversion code was not advanced enough to discern the difference.
He gapes at the screen for just a second and then flops onto his back with both hands over his face, shaking with laughter. Spock looks ridiculously pleased with himself, and he sees Nyota's face go from disbelieving to metaphorical light bulb.
That's what you were lying about.
What's that, Lieutenant? He said he hadn't seen or heard anything in the last 4 hours, and I could tell he was lying about something. She shakes her head, clearly amused despite herself.
Honestly, I thought he'd jump ship to your side. That's how off he was acting.
I could not disclose my plans to you, Lieutenant, as we still had not determined the precise extent of the captain's ability to hear and see aboard. No terminal or communications route seemed to be completely secure, and our success was reliant upon complete surprise.
And how did you pull this off without anyone knowing, sir?
Sulu's tone is one of mad respect, and Jim doesn't blame him in the least. Spock raises an eyebrow as if he cannot believe the stupid humans can't figure it out for themselves.
I requisition the assistance of Dr. McCoy, as his movements in the game would no longer be traced by the computer, and we perform the relocation during the time period in which the rest of you were physically scouring the ship's lower decks.
You ran me to ground, and then cheated.
He sits back up, leaning on one hand and wiping his streaming eyes with the other.
That's amazing.
He can see his first officer's posture loosen ever so slightly, as if Spock had thought he might be angry instead of absolutely over the moon right now. He's grown well beyond being a sore loser, and he's nothing but proud of his people at this point. Still looking completely taken off guard, Chekhov glances from the empty hole where the chair used to be to the screen. "So, we won, da?" He snorts and scrambles back to his feet, tossing the phaser rifle to the side somewhere. "Yes, Mr. Chekhov, I would say you won." He laughs as Sulu raises a tired fist in celebration and then hastily covers a yawn. "I'll be up in 5. Let's get those scores calculated and then pack it up before the crew starts beaming back aboard. I'll take care of the foam and deleting my extra programming from the core, and you can all get a nap before we get things up and running again."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Will I have something to sit in when the crew gets back tonight?" he asks, grinning. "Or is it a permanent prisoner of war?"
Spock's eyes glint with amusement in the light of the viewscreen.
"I believe an exchange can be arranged, sir."
"Much appreciated." He glances across the desk at his entirely too smug CMO. "You do know that I'll expect this kind of teamwork from you two during the next crew evaluations."
"Worth it,"
McCoy drawls, leaning back in his chair and folding his hands lazily behind his head.
"Worth it."
He goes to leave, but half turns before he triggers the door sensor. "And Spock," he calls.
"Sir?"
"Nicely done, Commander." He grins again. "You may indeed accept my capitulation." Starfleet is decidedly unimpressed with both their off-books adaptation of the war game module and his crew's immediate braggadocio all over the nets regarding their scoring, but it's all foam under the sandwich now. They won, relatively fair and square, and he's completely fine with that outcome, because even when he loses, he wins. The end.